If you'd like to join this conversation, it's easy. All you have to do is give us a call if you're in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we'd like to hear from you this morning. What is the study group on Arab-Israeli peacemaking, and how did the work of this group lead to the book?
Well, it's a great question, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you a little bit more about it. The debate, as many of your listeners know, the debate in our country about the Middle East and about Arab-Israeli peacemaking is often conducted at the margin. President Carter, unfortunately, with a book last year, setting the content of the book aside, created a firestorm of views, pushing the debate towards one end of the spectrum. An academic from University of Chicago and Harvard University published a book about called The Israel Lobby, doing the same. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people making accusations that this whole process has failed because of one or another Arab leaders. And to make a long story short, the debate is very, very much polarized. And what we tried to do, we brought together five top-notch people, three of them academics who have impeccable credentials, Steven Spiegel from the University of California in Los Angeles, Bill Quandt, who teaches at the University of Virginia, served in the National Security Council, one of our most acknowledged and respected authorities on the Middle East, and Shibli Telhami, who many people know because he's quite well-known in the public sphere. He's at the University of Maryland, and the Brookings Institution. He holds the Anwar Sadat Chair. And together with myself and the resources of the Institute of Peace and the leadership of Ambassador Kurtzer, we went around, we spent about a year, we talked to 100 officials and former negotiators and civil society leaders here in our country, in the Middle East, in Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Palestinians, Syria. And we tried to tell a story that's not a chronology, but we try to tell a story about our peacemaking the last 15 or 20 years. We highlight some of the successes, but we also focus on what, unfortunately, were far too many failures, sometimes failures of omission, sometimes failures of commission. And we created this book, which really is essentially a guidebook. We have 10 core lessons for the next generation of negotiators: how to use the president effectively, what's the proper role of Congress with peacemaking, how do you deal with domestic politics in the region and at home, and a whole sundry list. We can get into some of those particular issues if we want, but that's why we got together this group. That's why we targeted an issue that has a very much a polarized debate, but we tried to come up with some objective, dispassionate analysis. We can bring the debate back to the center, focus on our past mistakes, also some of our successes, but all the while looking ahead. Mm-hmm. What should the next administration be doing? And how can we build? Because if you look back, not just over the last 15 years, if you look back over 50 years, the U.S. has a lot to be proud of. We brokered Israeli-Egyptian peace. We've done a lot to help sustain peace between Jordan and Israel. There is a foundation on which to build on, and I don't think our best days are behind us. They may very well be in front of us.
You write that President Bush's attempts to reinvigorate the Middle East peace process will fail unless his administration pays more attention to lessons learned in past negotiations. What were some of those lessons that you're highlighting?
Well, let me focus on a couple of them. One is when it comes to, and this is a multi-leveled process. When you talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's not just, two actors, Israel and the Arabs. It's a very diverse set of actors, and it's a conflict and a peace process that's operating at many levels. Let's just focus on one, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, what many believe to be the core of the conflict. When it comes to that particular issue, and we focus quite a bit on this in the book, the U.S. needs to be, first of all, our diplomacy has to be not just adept, but sensitive to the asymmetries of power between the parties. You're dealing with one party, a very powerful party, Israel, which has built a successful state, a state that many in this country admire, a strong economy, strong military. But they're paired against a non-state actor. Palestinians don't have a state. There are people under occupation. We can't treat them, and we can't mediate between them the way we would mediate between, let's say, Egypt and Israel. It's a very different circumstance. We have to tailor our diplomacy to address those asymmetries of power. And part of what that means is that when it comes to the negotiations, which we've been sponsoring the last number of months, in which the President Bush kicked off at Annapolis a few months ago, is that when we encourage the sides to talk, we have to be in the room. We can't leave them on their own. The past, if the past is prologue, when Israelis and Palestinians talk by themselves, all kinds of asymmetries of power and other embedded obstacles to their resolving their conflict will come out, and negotiations can't sustain themselves when they're on their own. We need to be there in the room. We need to be at the table. We need to be offering ideas. Ways to for them to overcome obstacles, which are going to be inevitable. That's just one issue. In the current process, coming away from Annapolis, and this is where I think the Bush administration needs to be faulted, they have imagined and created our role as essentially on the sideline, as a facilitator. I think the president was reported to have told the Prime Minister Olmert and President Abbas, the Palestinian leader, when they left Washington in late November, you know, we're with you. Something to the effect of, you know, I'm just a phone call away. Well, we can't just be a phone call away. We need to be in the room. That's one issue. And second, I'd say, and I'll keep this one brief, the president pledged in Annapolis that we would be the judge. Those are his words. We would monitor if Israelis and Palestinians were complying. And that's a terrific thing to be doing. That's exactly what the U.S. needs to be doing. In fact, that's one of the key lessons in our book. We've learned from 15, 20 years of largely failed diplomacy. If we're not monitoring the compliance of each side, things can fall apart, and they can fall apart quickly. The problem is that the president has pledged to be a judge, and there's been no indication the last 3 or 4 months that we're actually going to be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just two deficits, our basic role being outside the room when we really need to be inside the room, and failing to really operationalize and turn this commitment to monitoring and judging into something that's real and credible.
Our guest is Scott Lisensky, Acting Vice President and Senior Research Associate at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention in the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open for your call. If you're in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Please note that the numbers that we're using are not the normal Milwaukee numbers that Kathleen Dunn uses. These are the Madison numbers. And so it's Madison 263-1890, otherwise 800-642-1234. Is the decline in American diplomacy a relatively recent phenomenon, and can it be reversed easily?
The decline that we talk about has been a slow decline since the end of the Cold War. Is it going to be easy to reverse? I mean, let me just say it's possible. You need a determined president, a president who and a leading group of leading advisors, the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State, who I think buck the trend in Washington. You know, there's been too much of a trend in Washington on Inauguration Day. A new administration comes to office, and they only look forward. They never look back. There used to be a sense that when it came to foreign policy and national security policy, that domestic politics ended at the water's edge, as it was often said.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last 15, 20 years, there's been two or three very rough transitions between administrations, and a sense of diplomatic amnesia has taken hold. And too many administrations, as I said, they tend to only look forward. Our diplomacy begins on Inauguration Day, and they don't remember what our legacy and what we've learned from past experience. So I think part of it, we just need we need not only a team that's willing to understand and appreciate what we've done right and what we've done wrong in our diplomacy, but you need a president who's at the basic level committed. Our book, Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, has a very clear and a very central critique about the current administration, that in the last 7 years, this issue, Israel's conflict with its Arab neighbors and how that fits into the larger strategic environment in the Middle East, has fundamentally been devalued and been pushed down on the agenda. We think that's wrong. The first place to begin is to have a commitment and to recognize the U.S. has put a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of prestige into this issue over 30 years, and we have a lot at stake. And our goal needs to be a comprehensive resolution of the conflict. It may take time, but that has to be our goal and it has to be a top priority. It can't be pushed aside.
Let's take some calls. We'll start with Jody in Downing. Jody, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I think it's wonderful that you're working on this from the peace perspective, really focusing on that. And, boy, I've been so disenchanted with this administration because it seems like they put a lot of talk in and no effort. So I wanted to commend you on, in hoping that you can get their attention. But I also had a question of when we are so, our corporations are so involved in the sale of arms to Israel, how much do you see that as getting in the way of making peace? And I've just read Jimmy Carter's book, and boy, the history and just his attention to all the different sides and their points of view, and realizing that this president doesn't have a clue. So I'll hang up and listen to your answers.
Jody, thanks for the call.
It's a great question. Let me just say this. One of the fundamental calculations that American leaders made way back in the 70s when we first got involved in Arab-Israeli peacemaking was that we're not going to be successful unless Israel feels secure. Israel, whether you think it's strong or weak, is a nation that feels threatened. Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon, these are names that may not dredge up a lot of excitement and admiration, but Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, later Gerald Ford, they really latched on to something, and it was an effective formula. We provide the economic and military assistance to Israel, political guarantees, security guarantees. We come to their defense if they're under threat. And that's the kind of formula that will allow them then to take risks for peace. They did it with Egypt. They tried to do it with the Palestinians in the 90s. The process was poorly constructed. But I think they can do it again. And fundamentally, that's the bargain. So it's not that our military assistance to Israel, which has remained fairly steady the last number of years, it's not as if that's an obstacle. That's a necessary condition for progress in the process. The key is how the U.S. uses that assistance. We don't use that assistance to give Israel a blank check and to say, then, okay, go ahead and do what you want. We need to leverage it for peacemaking. So, for example, the war in Lebanon, 2006. Sure, we understood Israel was threatened, and Israel was attacked by Hezbollah, and they had every right to respond. And we provided some equipment to the Israelis, which they wanted both for real reasons and for demonstrative reasons during the fighting. But we shouldn't have waited a month to push for a ceasefire. We should have intervened much sooner and then used that moment of turmoil, just like Kissinger and Nixon used in 73, Yom Kippur, Arab-Israeli War in October 1973. George Bush, the father, used the U.S. victory in the first Gulf War. When the strategic environment sort of changes and the chessboard gets all, everything gets moved around, that's the moment when we need to come in with our diplomacy. But unfortunately, we've been too much on the sidelines. So I wouldn't focus too much on the security assistance and the military aid to Israel as an obstacle. It very much can be the secret to our success. It just has to be used effectively. And we have to understand that that's one of the sources of our influence and our leverage. And we need to tap it.
We will take calls from Paul and Al in just a moment as we continue to talk with Scott Lisinski, Acting Vice President and Senior Research Associate in the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, United States Institute of Peace. He's co-author of Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East. You can find out more about the United States Institute of Peace at usip.org. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to have you along with us this morning. Carmen Jackson is our on-air producer, and we're looking for your calls as we talk about the Middle East situation. Our guest is Scott Lisinski, who is the co-author of Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East. The number for you to call if you'd like to be on the air and talk about this topic in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Paul next in Slinger. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. You know, if you go to Jane's Defense Weekly and the Federation of American Scientists website and look also at the Congressional Research Service site, you'll find that Israel is an advanced industrialized nation, and they are a major weapons producer. They do major research in collaboration with United States, South African, and EU countries in advanced weapon systems. So my question is, why do we not loan them but give them billions of dollars a year? And why is it that if you go and look at their annual budget and you can find nothing as it relates to the funding of all their settlements or their squatters taking over Palestinian lands and also their underground aquifer waters. You cannot find, just go on and see if you can find anything as it relates to those costs. And all those costs, the building of these illegal settlements, are being funded by you and me, the U.S. taxpayer. And it's funding and it's building enormous animosity and hatred of the Palestinian people who have an equal right to have a sovereign nation there.
The caller raised two issues. The one focused on the Israeli military industry. It's somewhat separate from the peacemaking question, but let me just say a word or two. Not only do we provide the U.S. and has for over 25 years provide a substantial amount of military assistance to Israel, the Israelis have also, as the caller rightfully recognized, the Israelis have built their own defense industry, which is very much based on export. Why do they do it? Well, their own defense market locally isn't enough for them to sustain the kind of R&D needed to come up with advanced weaponry to maintain what U.S. presidents have committed to maintain, which is Israel's qualitative edge militarily over its neighbors. And that's a longstanding and, I think, a very bipartisan issue. If we're going to press Israel to make concessions in peacemaking, then they have a very small margin of error. We should stand behind them as they maintain a qualitative military edge. Now, that being the case, there have been cases, and they've been far too frequent in the 90s and even in this decade, where the Israelis, I think, have pushed our agreements on export, military exports, to the limits, whether it's China, India. There have been other cases. And I think our defense community certainly is aware of it. They've been watching carefully. But our political leaders, I think, need to be a little bit more sensitive to that. And I think we should hold the Israelis to a much higher standard. They need to not just respect the letter of our agreements and what they can and cannot be exporting abroad, but they should be true to the spirit of those agreements. That issue is a little bit separate from the peacemaking question. The caller also mentioned the question of settlements. And here, it raises all kinds of passions both here and, of course, over in the Middle East as well. But on this question, I think there's unanimity. There certainly was in our study group, and we have large sections in the book about this, on the settlements question, on Israel's project of building civilian settlements, communities, in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. It was a wrong-headed decision. Our presidents early on in the 70s and early 80s understood this. Our diplomacy, for some reason, throughout the 90s and into this decade, has essentially walked away from the issue. And what we've done, and it's really tragic, I have to tell you, it's tragic because I know Israel very well, and I know Israelis well, and I spent a lot of time there. Israelis struggle with this issue. What we missed in this country, because we had Israeli political leaders who were being driven by fairly extreme and narrow political constituencies who were pushing them on a settlement issue, we heard one message from Israeli leaders, but we missed in this country, we missed that the bulk of Israeli society wasn't behind the settlement enterprise. And what they're facing today is a very vast network of settlements in the West Bank. They've now withdrawn from Gaza, but the network in the West Bank is vast, continuing to grow, growing illegally. Illegally, and I'm not using my words, I'm using the words from a report that Ariel Sharon, the former Israeli prime minister, commissioned his own government report two, 3 years ago, Sasson Report it's called, mm-hmm. which documented the pattern of illegal settlement building. That's illegal according to Israeli law. The U.S. needs to have a much stronger position on the settlement question. I think the next administration, if they do it in the context of a revived peace process, they will find that it actually resonates well in Israel. The Israelis are looking for a way out of the settlement question, and we should help them find it.
Paul, thank you very much for the call, for bringing up those points. Let's move on to Al in Milwaukee next. Hello, Al.
Hi, good morning. It's very fitting that you have this program 2 days after the Democratic primary. The problem goes back to 1947, as Margaret Truman says in a book she wrote about her father. The State Department warned Truman, do not partition Palestine, do not recognize Israel, you'll bring nothing but trouble from the Arabs. And that is exactly what we have seen. Unfortunately, the Democrat financial fundraisers went to Truman and said, look, if you don't partition Palestine, if you don't recognize Israel, we're going to lose a lot of contributions. And we've seen that the State Department was right. Israel has been nothing but trouble for the United States ever since. The only benefit I can think that we ever got from Israel was during the Cold War. It was a source of spying on the Soviet Union. What we should do today is simply cut loose. No more money, no more vetoes of United Nations Security Council resolutions that criticize Israel. Just cut it loose. It can take care of itself. Let's bring our money back home. Let's turn this into America for Americans. Thank you. I'll take the answer off the air.
Al, thanks for the call.
I appreciate the comments, but I have to respectfully disagree with the caller. Israel hasn't been a burden on the U.S. Israel's a great friend of the U.S. and vice versa. Now, that being said, the U.S., and it's not really so much from Truman's time. Truman recognized Israel, but the U.S. hadn't been engaged in the issue, really deeply engaged until the 70s, Nixon presidency. And we've been engaged because we understood that if we can help moderate, tamp down, and eventually resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, it opens up tremendous opportunities for the U.S. During the Cold War, being an Arab-Israeli peacemaker helped the U.S. change the whole strategic environment in the Middle East, away from the Soviets and toward us. The Israel-Egypt peace agreement was a major breakthrough in shifting the balance of power in the region in our favor. Not only was it was sort of a two-for-one, you might say, not only did we help secure and provide safety for our ally Israel, but in mediating that one dispute, that very combustible dimension of the conflict, the Israeli-Egyptian track, by bringing peace there, we helped shift the whole strategic calculus of the Cold War in the Middle East. Now, fast forward to today, Cold War is over, but there's a different kind of challenge going on in the Middle East and the Arab world, radicalism, Islamist militancy. And I think the analogy is apt. If we can mount a successful Arab-Israeli peacemaking effort, and I know we can because we've done it in the past, and we should learn from our mistakes of when we haven't been successful. If we can mount a successful effort today, we could do a lot to change the calculus in terms of radicalism and Islamist militancy. What I think the caller maybe fails to recognize is that what's happening in the Arab world, and it's happening sometimes quietly, sometimes vocally, there's a fairly broad recognition of Israel's permanence in the region and acceptance of Israel. And this is very much represented in the Arab League initiative, the initiative of the Arab League, the multilateral organization, saying we are prepared to recognize Israel and establish a normal relation once the conflict is resolved, Syria, Lebanon, the Palestinians. That's the kind of initiative the U.S. needs to grab onto. I think... I hope what the next administration will. There's one candidate who's running who's promising a status quo approach to our foreign policy, so it raises some questions about Middle East peacemaking. I think on the Democratic side, both candidates have voiced a very strong commitment to trying to revive our peacemaking efforts. We can gain a lot. It's not just in brokering peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors and in improving their lives, but we can gain a lot for the U.S., for our position writ large across the region. And I'll say this, and it may come up in one of the other questions, but should the U.S. withdraw from Iraq, and here there's a major difference in the election between the candidates, but if a candidate wins who's committed to withdrawing from Iraq, whether according to a timetable or not, I think that's going to raise a whole new phase of bargaining and of multilateral diplomacy in the region. Some of Iraq's neighbors are some of Israel's neighbors, and there's, I think there's going to be some linkage between U.S. withdrawal from Iraq or a dramatic change of our posture there and the Arab-Israeli question. Should supporters of Israel worry about that kind of linkage? Is Israel somehow going to pay the price for an American withdrawal from Iraq? I would say absolutely not. In fact, one should be, and I'm a consequentialist, I think, if that's the motivation for us to get more deeply involved, then so be it. Israel and its Arab neighbors may benefit, I think, from the kind of hard bargaining and the renewed attention to diplomacy and peacemaking that may come out of an American withdrawal.
Condoleezza Rice has been in the Middle East for the last few days. She, I believe, is in Brussels today, attending a NATO meeting. But is the kind of diplomacy efforts that she's making consistent with the efforts that you're advocating?
Well, one has to applaud the Secretary of State, albeit late, but the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, over the last year has demonstrated a commitment to this issue, a commitment that wasn't there in the first 6 or 7 years of the administration. And, know, and I certainly applaud them for that, and I think, again, I'm a consequentialist. Let's set the motives aside, but she's committed, and I think you need to take that at face value. But the problem is, and I think I said this at the outset of the hour, we're failing to appreciate some of the lessons of the past. Rice and the American administration are imagining and constructing an American role, which has us on the sideline. We're not even in the room. We're not even at the table. Fundamentally, that's wrong. And then second, when it comes to the situation on the ground, because the situation on the ground, as we see from all the violence in Gaza, rocket attacks, Israeli incursions, negotiations around the table are never going to succeed if things on the ground are spiraling out of control. We need to have a diplomatic approach that puts as much effort on the talks and on the framework for a settlement as we do on the situation on the ground. We need to start thinking ceasefires. We're not going to talk to Hamas. We better find allies and partners out there who will. They may be a distasteful party to us. We certainly consider them, I think rightly so, a terrorist movement. But, you know, if they're exercising a veto over this process, we shouldn't let them do it.
Scott Lisensky, Senior Research Associate at the United States Institute of Peace, who focuses on Arab-Israeli relations and the regional dimensions of the Iraq crisis. He is the co-author of Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East, along with Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer. It's a book that's just out, I believe, last month or January?
Technically, it comes out in April. We're going to have a book launch here at the Institute of Peace next week, but you can, you know, it's on Amazon and our own bookstore. So it's out there to be consumed and read. And in fact, we had an opportunity to share an early draft with the Secretary of State herself just before the Annapolis meeting, and that's important because, you know, the Institute doesn't just publish books for, you know, book's sake. We want to inform public discourse, as I'm doing with you today, but we also want to make an impact on our policymakers and on our diplomats.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones and to Scott in La Crosse next. Hello, Scott.
Good morning to you both. My question was actually prompted by a call you had a while ago about the impact of campaign money, being as how my own cynical view that we have a Congress up for sale. I have long heard about the Jewish Political Action Committee being very effective in promoting the cause of the Israelis. Do you know, is there any kind of activity toward on the part of the Palestinians? Seemingly their allies have all the money in the world from their sale of oil. Is there any effort on their part to form the same kind of a group to buy themselves a few congresspeople? And if not, why not?
Well, there's no doubt that American Jewish and also evangelical Christian support for Israel and political action is far more organized and consolidated and unified in this country than on the Arab-American side. The Arab-American community and the Palestinian-American our book doesn't focus entirely on that question, but it's fairly easy to see when you study the issue. They're atomized. They're divided. It's hard. Even where the population centers are in the U.S., it doesn't necessarily lend itself to the kind of effective political advocacy that you see on the American Jewish side of the equation. But, you know, at the end of the day, and we say this pretty loud and clear in the book, people that look at our track record on Arab-Israeli diplomacy should not overstate the impact of domestic politics. Certainly there, no doubt about it, and the role of Congress, not just in setting expectations for our diplomats, but in approving a foreign aid, security assistance, it's absolutely there. And sometimes in the American Jewish community, anxieties develop, and tough questions are asked about our peacemaking. But make no mistake, at the end of the day, it's up to the President of the United States and his foreign policy team. What we found in our work and what we say in the book is that our success and our failures in peacemaking have largely been a result of decisions and judgments made by the team, by the president and his top team. It's not entirely defined by domestic politics here and what one constituency or advocacy community exercises. I just encourage listeners to sort of beware of those, you know, unicausal, those single explanations that try to boil everything down to, well, you know, we can't get anything done in the Middle East because of, you know, American domestic policy.
Scott, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Scott Lisensky, who is the co-author of Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East. And let's go to Don in New Auburn next. Hello, Don.
Yeah. All I got to say is if you're running a company or a government and you're allowing people to get money illegal, like Israel's been doing for 50 years, then using that money to have a Jewish lobby from Israel in our country, a foreign government, undermining the principles of our democracy. That is a crime in itself, and those people in Washington that have allowed it should be charged with war crimes, because all them people that are suffering these war crimes in the Middle East is completely due to this illegal operation in Washington of allowing them to bag money to our politicians. They're supposed to dictate laws and rules that are beneficial to the United States and the world, not allow this illegal war to go on and talk when they don't even have respect for Candace Rice to put her name in the paper, which I heard the other day on your radio. It's in the back page. Then what is a president like Obama going to do? You need somebody to stand up and say what you're doing there is war crimes, and we're going to charge you with war crimes and stop this illegal grafting money in Washington that is corrupting our politicians, and they should be put in jail. Anybody that accepted a dollar from this Jewish league that's politicking in our country. It's a foreign government. They have no business in our spending money to our politicians. That is a war crime in itself.
Don, thank you so much for your call and your response to that.
It's an impassioned set of comments. I respectfully differ with the caller on a few points. Number one, some of the groups and the communities that I was referencing earlier in this discussion, these are American organizations, mostly on the advocacy front, Jewish American groups, but there's Arab American as well. These are not agents of foreign governments. There's a long tradition in this country, and here some people think it's good, some people think it's not good, but there's a long tradition in our country of domestic groups, whether they're business or ethnic or religious, lobbying our government and often having major impacts on foreign policy. Look at our policy in Cuba, on trade, look at questions in Greek-Turkish relations. I could list 37 different issues for you. So, if you're against any domestic influence on foreign policy, that's a view people can have. But when it comes to this question, lobby groups, including Jewish American lobby groups, and I want to point out, this is something that's often lost, and we say this in the book. In fact, we have a quote from a former Secretary of State who was very adept. I think some other secretaries didn't pick up on this. There's a very diverse range of views among the American Jewish community and among the pro-Israel advocacy community. And if you're careful and you do it right, any president and their foreign policy team can build a coalition across different communities, bringing moderate Arab-American voices, bringing from the Jewish-American community groups. I don't need to name names, but the groups are out there who are very robust and strong-willed in their support of an active U.S. diplomatic engagement. You can bring them together into a coalition. In fact, President Clinton did this in many respects. He built a very successful coalition, unlike his predecessor, George H.W. Bush. Bush, the father, who, as we say in the book, was quite successful when it came to Arab-Israeli peacemaking. He did everything right. Had an experienced team. They had diverse views. There was a certain ferment and debate to policy. They had clear goals. We lay it all out in the book. The one thing he didn't do, he didn't pay attention to domestic politics. And he alienated a lot of people needlessly. Whether rightly or wrongly, domestic politics is one among, five or six key ingredients in a successful diplomatic approach, so you got to attend to it. President Clinton did. The tragedy is he built this tremendous coalition, and he didn't dip into it. He didn't leverage it. He didn't use his political capital on this question until the last days and weeks of his administration. By then, it was too late. So for a president, and hopefully the next president, will proactively build and focus at home on building a domestic network of support for Arab-Israeli peacemaking. Once you do it, be sure to use it before you lose it.
Our number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1890. 1234. That's a toll-free number. Email address is talk@wpr.org as we talk with Scott Lisensky, who is co-author of Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East. And in the book, there are 10 lessons to guide Arab-Israeli peacemaking. We'll talk about those, and we'll take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about negotiating Arab-Israeli peace. And in your book, Scott, you have talked about a course of action that the next administration should take. And talk about some of the key ingredients in this course of action.
Well, first and foremost, I think the next president needs to come to office and clarify something that's become confused in the minds of many in our country and in the region. In the first few months of the administration, we need to be clear that we have an interest in Arab-Israeli peace. We want to move the process forward. Our goal is a comprehensive Arab-Israeli settlement. We may not get there right away, but that's our goal, and we're going to move toward it. I think a second, that's really more in terms of expectations mm-hmm. and rhetoric. In terms of substance on the Palestinian question, there has been some progress in past negotiations. President Clinton achieved some, but it slipped away, and there have been a few other advancements here and there. We need to gather all the progress that's been achieved in the negotiations, whether it's on questions of Jerusalem and its status or the borders of the settlements. We need to come up with a basic outline, a basic set of parameters that should define a settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. We need to make it official U.S. policy. I believe, my co-author believes, and our study group asserts that it would really make a lot of sense. It would do the U.S. a lot of good, and it would also have an important effect on domestic politics in the Middle East, among Israelis and among Palestinians, that we, the U.S., put our name on a specific proposal for settlement. We then seek Arab support for it. We go to the U.N., get a Security Council resolution. We think it would be important. That outline, that framework for settlement, can help point the parties toward a common goal. Right now, we're pushing them into negotiations. We're encouraging them to get involved in a process, but we've never defined the destination. We think it's critical to define the destination. And third, we also say, as I said earlier in the hour, the next administration needs to have a very clear sense of how they're going to monitor the compliance of each party. When there's a signing ceremony or there's an agreement to commitments, as there was at Annapolis in November last year, we need to come up with an effective way to use every tool in our toolkit, from foreign aid to our political support and all kinds of other tools. We need to use everything we have in order to try to keep the parties to their commitments. We need to have a robust monitoring role. As I said earlier, we have to set out what the parameters should be. We should define the destination of what a settlement should be. And fundamentally, the next president needs to make a clear commitment and make sure that people in the region understand we're going to try to move this issue forward and that we see our role as being very much engaged at the table, active on the ground, and we're not going to be on the sidelines anymore.
Our guest is Scott Lisensky, and our next caller is Muriel from Sensua. Hello, Muriel.
Good morning. I appreciate your program. You're having peace is the most important issue of our time, I think, and especially in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I think is connected with this is our own domestic economy of our country and others also, that sometime in the past it was said if our economy begins to depend upon munitions industry, we're in trouble. And I think we're in trouble right now because of that to a large extent. And so I think our aid to Israel or any other country has to go beyond supporting their military activities, away from that to their domestic needs, and so that our effort goes into peaceful activities and peaceful support
mm-hmm.
rather than supporting their killing of other people. so that people will see us, or nations will see us, as someone who is on their side and helping them rather than giving them the possibility of destroying each other.
Scott, it sounds like she agrees with your aims.
You know, the comment, I very much appreciate the comment. Our foreign aid policy, when it comes to the Arabs and when it comes to Israel, I think there's two very different things going on. When it comes to the Israelis, and again, it's a very wealthy economy now. It wasn't always, but they've become quite strong economically. Our assistance is channeled largely to security questions, and I think that's where it needs to go. Again, you have to use it effectively. You've got to make sure the security assistance and the reassurance that that provides to Israel from our side gets leveraged into peacemaking efforts. On the Arab side, quite different, particularly given the status of economies there, but also given the deep skepticism and uncertainty which Arab publics, Palestinian or the larger Arab world, view the U.S. in terms of our intentions and our goals. We don't face this on the Israeli side, where the public is very much supportive and has, you know, very warm and close feelings to the U.S. On the Arab side, our foreign aid efforts have been scrutinized, and I think they are quite off balance. On the Palestinian side, we focus far too much on security assistance and on channeling too much of our aid and our expertise towards the security services which aren't trusted and which the populace doesn't have a faith in. In the larger Arab world, countries like Egypt and Jordan, our foreign assistance is probably out of whack. We give $2, $3, $4 for the military side for every dollar we devote to the economies there. I think at a minimum, our foreign aid program, in line with our goals and our priorities post 9/11, need to be at a minimum, dollar for dollar. When we give money to countries, Egypt, Jordan, others in the Arab world, at a minimum, it should be equal amounts toward economic projects that focus on jobs and improving the social indicators. I think that would go a long way to changing how people perceive the U.S.
How do you see the Arab-Israeli conflict intersecting with a larger question of Islamist militancy?
Terrific. It's a terrific question, Jim. You know, the Arab-Israeli conflict isn't, I don't want to give the wrong impression, given our book and this kind of blueprint we've given for American diplomats about how to bring peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors. This one question doesn't sort of unlock everything in the region. The question of Islamist militancy in the Arab world has, you know, probably more to do with long traditions of authoritarianism and how politics has been so stunted and how political development has been so stunted in Arab societies, both political, social, and economic development, has more to do with that than it does with the festering Arab-Israeli question. But at the same time, the festering Arab-Israeli dispute has added fuel to the fire. It's made it easier for Islamists to recruit not just people, but funding. And I think by, and it's not a direct, it's an indirect a benefit, but by trying to do better, by being more successful as an Arab-Israeli peace negotiator, we can take away one of the factors that's driving Islamist militancy. You still need to have reform and some kind of a new political bargain in key Arab states, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Egypt or elsewhere. It's not what our book is about, but from some of my other work, I can tell you still need to have that that change and a whole new paradigm in terms of politics back home, local politics in the Arab world. But if we can do better on the Arab-Israeli question, we can take away one of the factors that helps to rally support to the Islamist militant cause.
Let's go to the phones to Mike in Madison next. Hello, Mike. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had the wonderful opportunity of going to a Jewish synagogue? Is that a church, a Jewish church? And I noticed from what was being said and what was being displayed around, there is a Israeli flag at the front. There's no American flag up front. There's an Israeli flag in the front. And they talk about Israel as, you know, I'm not an Israeli, or I'm not a Jewish American, but they talk about Israel as if it's, you know, a sister country close to the heart. So for all these people who are calling up and saying, oh, we just need to, you know, cut off all ties to Israel, you have to understand, you have to understand the viewpoint from another person's eyes. There is an Israeli flag at the front of the Jewish church. There, they talk about Israel as the land of, you know, that God gave them. That, you know, you can't just take and rip out someone's religion out of their world and expect that we're going to just, you know, give up on Israel. That's just ludicrous. Our support for Israel will continue forever. And, you know, I don't know if there will ever be a resolution. I think America cannot resolve the problem. I think the problem has to be resolved between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I feel for the Palestinians, especially those who grew up in a refugee camp, and the only Israelis that they see in their world is a man or a woman wearing a helmet, you know, green fatigues, and a gun.
Mike, we're running late in the program, and I want to give Scott Lisinski a chance to respond to the argument that you're making.
Well, you know, there's no doubt the onus in this conflict is on the parties themselves to do most of the heavy lifting. I'm not arguing the onus is mostly on the U.S., but, you know, that said, they've proven they can't get to an effective peace process without us. And at a minimum, we can't, even if we're not being effective, I have to say, we have to be perceived in the region and in the larger international community as taking this issue seriously, at a minimum. And if we're not perceived, as we have been in the last 6 or 7 years, as taking the issue seriously, it hurts us. It hurts our diplomacy. So, you know, people have views about whether the conflict is resolvable or not. I tend to be much more optimistic. It's not a conflict divined from above. It's one created by people. It can be resolved. It may take time. It's a conflict, essentially, at its heart, about territory, about two peoples, about two nations that are trying to establish homelands, and it's a territorial question. It's become infused with all kinds of issues of radicalism and religion, but at its heart, it's a conflict about territory, and we can do a lot. Again, it's going to take time, but all along the way, the U.S. has to be perceived. It's very critical to our diplomacy in the Middle East and on the world stage that we're perceived as taking this issue seriously and working hard to mitigate it. Otherwise, we're going to pay a price, and I think you've seen we've been paying a price in the last few years.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Mo next in Amory. Hi, Mo.
Reedsburg?
Yeah. If you're Mo...
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
All right.
Then
well,
whatever
wanna,
we have is
yeah.
wrong.
Okay. I want to ask the guest about two major questions. One, I know he's going to spend lots of time on that, and that is the basic acknowledgement of the right of return of the Palestinians. And second different question is, does he think of the same of the Likud and some parts on the Likud, like Lieberman and others in Israel who called for the Arab transfer? And what about the late comment by the deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army that threatening Gaza with a Shoah or a Holocaust? Isn't that something kind of like you have to comment on in the course of your discussion today?
Sure. It's a whole set of questions. Let me be brief on each of them. The refugee question, no doubt, it's a key component. But I think we've already approached and we understand what the essential equation is on refugees in the context of a negotiated settlement. Palestinian refugees can return to a Palestinian state in Gaza or the West Bank. They can be resettled elsewhere. They can receive compensation where they are. Some are in Jordan, some are elsewhere. And they can return to areas that may be swapped, maybe territories that Israel and Palestinians agree to swap. The question of land swaps, I think, is a critical one. Small amount of territory, but it can go a long way to getting over some of the key obstacles. I think the refugee, how you resolve the refugee question is understood by a lot of people. The problem is that Palestinian leaders have trouble talking in a serious way and in a realistic way to their public. I think they should. I don't think we should press them too immediately. It's the kind of conversation that will be a lot easier for them to have if a peace process gets revived, starts to move forward. And if it should, then you know, a new U.S. administration should really press Palestinian leaders and Arab leaders to talk in a realistic way about how the refugee question is going to be resolved. In terms of Israel
Israeli politics. And the caller mentioned one of the more conservative members of the Israeli government, the Lieberman, and have one of the Israeli military leaders, or maybe it was a defense official in recent days, used the same word for what Israel was promising to do in Gaza, the same word that is used in Hebrew in Israel for the Nazi Holocaust. I mean, listen, let's just call a spade a spade. That was a very unfortunate use of language, something that the Israeli government, I think, should apologize for. I think the U.S., in its support for what Israel does in Gaza to stop rocket attacks, should be based entirely and solely on an effective and appropriate Israeli response. If Israel's heading into what you might call a demonstrative operation where they're trying to demonstrate, you know, Lord knows what, I think we need to be weighing in much stronger about how counterproductive that can be.
Thanks for giving us this advanced look at the book, Negotiating Arab-Israeli Peace, American Leadership in the Middle East. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Scott Lisensky is a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace, focusing on Arab-Israeli relations and the regional dimensions of the Iraq crisis. He's co-author of a book with Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer about negotiating Arab-Israeli peace. And we thank him for spending time with us today. You'll be hearing much about this in the next few weeks as the public relations campaign opens up on the book. I'm sorry we're not able to get to all of the calls today. We appreciate your calls. And we look forward to talking with you in the next hour. I'm Jim Packard. Our thanks to Carmen Jackson for on-air phone production, and also to our producers, Rhonda Fanning, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.